years before talking about the Salt Lake bombings and forgeries, and someone said to me this morning, I didn't know you were an expert on the environment. And I said, well, I'm not. But not being an expert has never stopped me from speaking before. I'm also not an expert on Native American religion or lifeways. I note with relief that I see no Indian faces here this morning. But what I am going to try to do is share some of my changing perspective on the environment as it has come to me through working with Indian people and on cross-cultural projects. You know, we hear so many times this whole concept that the pioneers came here and made the desert blossom as a rose. Comes as a bit of a shock to wonder why you would want the desert to blossom as a rose. I mean, a rose blossoms as a rose, right? And the desert should be a desert. And that is an Indian perspective, stated very simply. For the last couple of years, I've been working with a Ute spiritual leader and shaman. And as he visits our home and ponders the way our cats boss us around and looks at our aquarium of tropical fish, observes rush hour about 5 o'clock when everyone goes out to walk and jog, and says, where are all these people going? I said, well, you know, don't people walk in Neola? He thought a minute. He said, no. Indian people used to walk. They used to walk to the store, walk into town. Then we got automobiles. We go back and forth between cultural things and cultural perspectives. And the reason that I got into this at all, when Kristen called me, I had just proposed with a friend of mine, Bill Slaughter, another documentary to KUED that we called A Rush of Wings. Bill thought this one up. He called me up and said, you know, I've come across this group I've been talking with. It's a group that is interested in the conservation of eagles and hawks, raptors. And they track the migrations, the skyways, they call them. And they go up in the mountains and watch these birds fly over. They trap them and examine them, tag them, and monitor them. And the idea is that eagles and hawks, those big birds, are in effect canaries in the mine. And that you send the canaries in first. And if the canaries get in trouble, then you know that the people are in trouble. And he said, what about doing a documentary on this whole thing of the skyways and the eagles and the hawks and the relationship between the people? We saw some video that these people had taken of their project. And it's really quite remarkable how they get these animals to fly into the nets, actually by using other birds as bait. And I guess we don't talk about those birds. And then pick them up, hold them in their arms, golden eagles, red-tailed hawks. Examine them, make sure they're doing okay, put a tag on, and then hurl them into the air again and watch them fly off. Well, Bill had proposed several things to me in the last 6 months or so, none of which I was very interested in. This one I jumped at because I had just come back from another taping session with this Ute spiritual leader, Clifford Duncan, and for the second major trip to tape, which most of which we do either in my car or his pickup truck, we had seen eagles. The first time, it was just one eagle flying past us and over us as we were on our way south into Navajo country, actually. This time, we were on a bluff above the Green River, and as we sat there talking and taping, we looked down on an island. Now, I couldn't tell these were eagles, but Clifford could tell that there were 13 golden eagles circling around that island, hunting and returning, and looked as content as sparrows on my front lawn. And those eagles were there throughout our talk. Well, dimly, as this has gone on over the years, I've begun to realize that for me, seeing an eagle is a neat thing. For an Indian person, seeing an eagle is much more than that. One might as well be in the sacred grove, but the fact is that one is always in the sacred grove if one has that perspective. And seeing an eagle is seeing a messenger from God. So I told Bill, you know, environmentalists don't really know anything about eagles. Listen to this. And started trying to explain some of this to him. And we said, well, what if we took it from both points of view. What if we tried to incorporate the Native American point of view and the environmentalist point of view? And so that's where we've been going. Unfortunately, although we were going to start shooting this month, we've been postponed, and we hope to start shooting the migration next spring. It's difficult, really, to describe, to translate this kind of a worldview. The Sundance, one of the Sundances on the Ute Reservation just ended. And in the Sundance, whistles are used that are made of eagle bone. Eagle feathers are used. I went to a powwow recently, and every time an eagle feather dropped in the arena, a little mini ceremony was held to pick up that eagle feather with due respect. It's just those very parts of the eagle are revered. They're believed to possess in and of themselves as a spiritual power that I think in Christianity generally, and especially in Mormonism, which tends to be very rational, very abstract, very removed from tangible icons or anything that idols, we call them, unless of course they happen to be historical documents. It's difficult to really give that perspective of reverence for those things. You know, Joseph Smith wrote that the earth was spiritually created first. It was interesting to me as we put together Native and American, we got some illustrations of the creation myth in Navajo culture. And there were drawings of different animals, panthers, eagles, coyote, and so on. And the animals were drawn in two parts almost. There would be a three-dimensional part, and then there would be this kind of flat outline. And as we went over those over and over again, it dawned on us that we were seeing the spiritual form before it became the physical three-dimensional form. And when you look at probably even petroglyphs, but certainly later Indian art, 18th century, 19th century, 20th century, and see that flat representation does not necessarily mean that they haven't learned how to do three-dimensional art. But you're looking at representation of something symbolic, something spiritual, that is not meant to be of this world or what we would call realistic. And this concept of everything having a spirit is very strong. Now, I think most people know that Indians view the world in a spiritual way, that the trees have spirits and the rocks have spirits and the clouds have spirits. But what we tend to miss is that all of those spirits are individual. The peyote is a spirit. The river has a spirit. And it's an individual spirit. And all of them are co-equal. They are not here for us. We're all here together. And so if the eagles are in trouble, they're not in trouble to warn us that we might be in trouble. They are probably in trouble because of us. But their dilemma is a genuine dilemma just for them, as well as for whatever it might imply for human beings or for the rest of the planet. Now, that's a radical shift in perception, I think, from the way that we generally view the earth, the way that we view ourselves and our society, and the way that we view religion. Now, when one works in the media, all of this becomes very difficult, and all of these cross-cultural things really become heightened. For example, when we were, well, for one thing, I talked to Clifford Duncan about this documentary idea, and he said, yeah, I'll work with you guys. Well, as we got into it a little further, all of a sudden I found him backing off. He didn't want to do it. And, you know, no matter, I mean, I have learned over the years, I guess, a certain number of ploys to either get people to talk or to do what I want them to do. I don't consider myself any match for him in most situations, but it was just clear that he didn't want to do it. And so then I started trying to find out why. Okay, well then what could we do? What kinds of artifacts could we film? Could we film these eagle bone whistles in museums? Where could we film feathers? He said, well, the museums are starting to give these things back. And so You know, the underlying part of that is it wasn't appropriate for them to have them, and even if they still do have them, it's not really appropriate for you to be filming them. He began to recommend to me other spiritual leaders whom I happen to know he considers susceptible to Anglicization. I mean, they're sort of white people's medicine men. And they might cooperate. They might be willing to do this. But still, there's that undercurrent of we're crossing a line, that just in photographing these things, we're crossing a line. Well, I knew that because when we did Native and American, I would find myself heading toward Navajo country with a film crew who had all of their own ethics of what's news, what can be photographed, get it and go. You'll probably never have to come back. You know, you burn your bridges. Of course, the next people down have to deal with those burned bridges, but it probably won't be you. And my usual comparison was, well, it's like filming a religious ceremony is like asking to go in and film the temple ceremony. Well, that usually made sense to them. And we did interview a couple of medicine men. One of them we interviewed in a hogan that he had held a ceremony in the night before, and we'd stood outside the hogan for a long time waiting for his grandson to talk to him about this, and we had watched the people coming and going. The next day we were sitting in that hogan, he was talking, I went as far as I could go and as far as I needed to go in terms of asking him, what can you show us, what can you tell us? He told us about twice as much as he intended to, but he was not going to bring out the instruments of his healing, and I knew that he wouldn't. But when we got back in the editing studio, this was very frustrating to some of the people working on the show, because such things have been photographed or filmed before. We ought to have it. We need it. You know, we ought to have it. And finally, one person working on the show, who shall remain nameless, and was not Bill Slaughter, and I almost came to a divorce, I guess, over this issue, because he was just saying, well, you know, maybe we should have offered him a couple $100. And I said, well, why don't you go downtown? You'll probably have to raise your price, but why don't you go downtown and offer some money to film the temple ceremony? And he said, well, yeah, I know, but you've got to realize that these medicine men, these people, this is the way they make their living. And I said, you don't think it's the way the men downtown make their living? Then we separated and went in different rooms and chatted for a while, and then we came back and we finished making the show. But the point of it is that the things that we see as sacred tend to be enclosed within structures that are made by human beings. They're made, they may be made with wood and stone, but they're also made with plastic and other synthetic materials. When you live in a world that is spiritual, when the plants are your sacrament, and the animals bear God's power as delegated to them, and then you start talking about filming and what's okay and what's not, It's a hard concept for us to realize. But I think what's at the essence of it is a spirituality that most of us are not really even prepared to deal with in terms of being part of a world that is composed of spirit and where everything counts, where everything we do is connected to everything else that happens. Those of you that are Tony Hillerman fans are picking up on this, that Jim Chee will watch a crow fly and know that something is happening over here. And it's that concept of all these invisible lines weaving the world together, and that we are part of that, but we don't dominate it, we don't subdue it, we don't make the desert blossom as a rose. Thank you.
What are we going to do about Utah? This was a question that a moderator for a similar panel used earlier this year in a writers' conference in Missoula. And what he was doing was introducing a panel of writers who are also politically involved in the environment. And when he got to Terry Tempest Williams, that was the question that he used to introduce her. And I think this question is prompted by a reputation that Utah has, where on one hand we have this incredible landscape, which is probably as beautiful and diverse as any place on the earth, but on the other hand we have this population which is fairly difficult to move in the direction of preservation. As usual, Terry answered this question with a story. And the story she told was based on an experience she had with a group of LDS single people down in the desert. It was an outing that they were on. And she'd been asked to give a talk, and part of her talk consisted of a scripture that she wanted to read. And just as she began to read the scripture, from the rocks behind her, a pack of coyotes began to howl. And this was delightful for Terry and also for the audience. And this business of God speaking through coyotes, I think, is a step in the right direction. What I'd like to do today is discuss some factors which I've written down that I think are unique to Mormonism and also kind of put up a wall in front of environmentalists as far as being able to deal with this preservation issue. I'm going to just go through this list. The first one is that the way towns in southern Utah were settled is unique to Mormonism. I think the people would go out into the land to set up new outposts for Zion, to spread the gospel geographically. Whereas in other places in the West, there may have been a different reason, an economical reason to settle a new place. Based on many scriptures, Mormons see the land and its natural resources as having been created for their use. The issue of suppression of the feminine, I think it's a very masculine idea to go out into the land and look at it in terms of which resources are valuable, which ones aren't, what the land can do for me. It's the masculine side of me that relates to those kind of issues, where it's the feminine side of me that discusses the beauty. I think early on the pioneers could go out into the land and take as much land as they thought they needed as long as they could take care of it. There was nothing mentioned about what it would cost or it, as having a monetary value. It's just what they needed they could have. Mormons are known for large families, and they are also known for wanting to keep children and grandchildren in the same geographic location. I think that any religion would like this, but I think we as Mormons are really, really place a high priority on keeping our families together, not only spiritually, but also geographically. I've been involved in a lot of wilderness issues, and I've been on the wilderness side, and I've heard a lot of statements made in opposition to wilderness, and usually they're very general statements on both sides. And what I wanted to do for for this panel was to really try and get into the inside of the other side and look at some specific examples. So what I've done is I picked the little town of Escalante, Utah, and I'm not sure that it typifies every southern Utah town, but I think it's fairly close. It's mainly Mormon. It's part of Garfield County, which is 87.8% owned by the federal government and only 4.2% owned by private individuals. And it's surrounded right now, for those of you who don't know, that we're embroiled in a wilderness debate which involves the lands that are held by the BLM, which have characteristics of wilderness. And if you look at the maps that have been published, Escalante is right in the middle of thousands and thousands of acres of potential wilderness. And people of Escalante have been traditionally anti-wilderness. And they've also are passionate in their ideas. And I don't know how many of the rumors I've heard are true, but you need to be careful when you leave your car in Escalante if there's any indication that you're an environmentalist. We have a friend who's a landscape photographer, and he goes to Escalante frequently because the landscape is so beautiful, and he's able to, you know, sell his pictures that he takes from there. And he makes a point of covering up his Sierra Club bumper sticker with one that says BYU Blue. And what I want to do is take those factors that I've mentioned previously and relate them just to Escalante. And I was fortunate, in the library, there's a book called The Escalante Story, which is a history of this small town. And from it, I learned a lot of things. Regarding the settlement, what happened were two groups of men from Panguitch decided that it was time to spread out, to start fresh in a new area, and they found this place called Potato Valley. That was the name of Escalante before it was called Escalante. And it had a better climate than Panguitch, so they, about eight people, went out and looked around and came back with some real promising ideas about what could happen in this place. And I think, I'm no historian, but usually it would seem that a place would get settled as a result of something already there, like a ranching community or a rendezvous point or an old fort or something. But this place was settled just because it looked beautiful. There were Indians there, but they made a deal with the Indians early on. It was beautiful, and they decided we'll move here and we'll figure it out later how we're going to support ourselves. As far as regarding the use of natural resources, any of you have heard any of the debates, anybody from Garfield County or Escalante always uses the argument that if the federal government locks up any more of our land, we're going to find it more and more difficult to have any standard of living at all, and our families aren't going to be able to stay here. That's a very strong argument used by anti-wilderness factions. As far as the feminine goes, the history quotes LDS records about this first visit to this Potato Valley. I'm going to quote, "These brethren, being favorably impressed with the country, measured some of the land and estimated there were 1,000 or more acres of arable land. They also found a great bed of plaster of Paris in the hills to the southeast," unquote. They also brought back reports of grassy plains that would allow for livestock grazing, and early on they figured that the small flow in the stream could be increased to allow for greater farming. In contrast to this, I want to read a quote from Clarence Dutton. Clarence Dutton was a geologist who traveled with John Wesley Powell, and they visited this area at the same time. And this is a completely different place he describes. It is a sublime panorama. The heart of the inner plateau country is spread out before us in a bird's eye view. It is a maze of cliffs and terraces lined off with stratification of crumbling buttes, red and white domes, rock platforms gashed with profound canyons, all glowing with bright color and flooded with blazing sunlight. See, Dutton was really able to let his feminine side appreciate the beauty of this land, and it overwhelmed the masculine part of him that was supposed to describe some of the geological attraction it might have for mining. As far as disposition of the land, quoting again from the history, they made a temporary survey, each man claiming one or more 40-acre pieces, which they expected to divide among other settlers with a view to building up a town. They planned that each man should have exactly 20 acres of farmland, 2.5 acres of pasture, and when the town site should be laid out, 1 1/4 acres for a city lot. And none of this would cost them a dime. They may have had to pay something to have it surveyed. But I can really see how, with these people in Escalante now that are living in the places that their forefathers settled, that it's very difficult for them to have the federal government tell them that this is what you get and it's all you get, and that's it, whereas they had this free access to it in the beginning. As far as regarding the idea of large families and keeping the families together, all through this historical book, there are a few names that kept cropping up right from the very beginning. And I picked six of them just for the sake of illustration, and I followed them all through the history. These are last names. Alvey, Barney, and Spencer were part of the two original groups who traveled to Potato Valley to assess the possibilities in 1875. Cottam, Lyman, and Porter arrived within a year or two. Alvey built the first house on the town site, and Porter brought in the first threshing machine. A Porter, an Alvey, and a Cottam, and a Spencer were all members of the 1892 Ward Choir. One Alvey, one Barney, one Spencer, and four Porters attended School District No. 1 in 1897. A Spencer, a Cottam, and a Barney died in World War II. A Lyman was the first sawmill owner. Three Spencers and an Alvey played on the 1925 women's basketball team. And a Barney helped search for Everett Roos. Today, I just for fun, I looked in the phone book, the Escalante Boulder phone book, and I estimated just as quickly without counting them, there were 400 to 500 phones in these two towns, and probably 400 of them are in Escalante. And of those 400 phones, 13 belong to Alvey's, 9 to Barney's, 12 to Spencer's, 6 to Cottom's, 10 to Lineman's, and 11 to Porter's. So I think what we're seeing here is these families that were there right from the very beginning have stayed there and eked out an existence with much opposition and still managed to maintain this integrity. And it's really cast a new light on the whole situation for me. And I began to wonder how they've done it. And early on, this history describes some of the things that these people did. It lists dairying, molasses making, honeybees, carpet weaving, hide tanning, shoemaking, basket making, barrel making, sawmills, blacksmithing, building, mining for coal and gold, drilling for oil, and, of course, ranching and farming. And among that list, there are only two or three things that are really still viable today. And this is a situation typical of small-town America, wherever you are, and that is that as transportation and communication and technology have increased, the need for these small little industrial centers has really decreased. And another thing that is kind of obvious to me, and I'm not sure if it's true, but it would seem that with all those different ways of producing different things, you wouldn't really need a lot of currency. And, I'm sure the barter system was set up, and you could probably get by with everything you needed right from the small town. Well, nowadays, since everything is not available and the need for currency is so much greater, you can really see how these families in Escalante are having a much more difficult time. The ranching and farming are marginal at best. There's some mining, hotels, tourists, that kind of thing. But I don't think it's like it used to be. So what happens? Any mention of locking up these lands that surround Escalante brings more fear to these people, that there will be fewer chances to make the living that they need to support their lifestyle. And this fear, I think, leads to a frustration, which in turn leads to rage. And based on this reading that I've done, I really can't blame them for that. I'm growing weary, too, of listening to wilderness debates where on one side the Garfield County Commissioner is discussing the fate of the people that live in the county, and on the other side, wilderness advocates are talking about their ideals. You know, both sides are incredibly passionate about their situation, and they both promise each other that their facts are correct. But the big problem is it's almost like they are speaking a different language. They are not communicating to each other. And I've listened to many of these, and it is frustrating. And I think the main reason for them is to convince anybody who's listening or watching these debates that they're trying to convince these people that one side is better than the other. And I think that's the only part that they really play. But I think what needs to happen is we need to find a ground where these two sides can talk to each other. This business of the highest level, when the people, the Mormons from Southern, thinking about religion and eternal life and keeping families together, that's an awfully high level. And on the other side, the people advocating wilderness are talking about the spiritual values of wilderness and the peace that it brings and the fact that our species evolved in land like this. That's an awfully high ideal. And I think as long as we're talking about high ideals, there's no possibility of compromise. So it may be a sacrilege to both sides, but I think we need to come down onto a lower level and at least temporarily discuss these issues in a venue which there is some argument and opinions, but it's still there's some place for compromise. I think economics could be that level. Granted, it's blasphemous to talk to either of these sides in terms of dollars and cents. It would be just as absurd to ask Brant Calkin of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance to put a dollar value on Death Hollow as far as what it would cost to get him to withdraw that from a wilderness study area designation. But it would be just as absurd to ask Lincoln Lyman to close up his construction business in Escalante and move to Las Vegas where the economy is better. So I think we're talking about money, but we have to deal with it with certain restrictions. I've got a couple ideas here. Ideally, maybe each potential wilderness area needs to be studied in terms of its economic benefits. I mean, so often we hear from one side that you designate any wilderness at all, it means it's going to cost us jobs. All right, let's take them case by case, and let's look at them in terms of, okay, it's going to cost you jobs, how many jobs? What are those jobs worth? Let's put a dollar figure on that and come up with some plans where we take land from here and we can turn that into wilderness, but this over here we won't. When we come up with some real advantages to doing one or the other with these different parcels of land. This would take a lot of work, but I think it's important. More studies need to be done on the economic value of wilderness. There was one done in 1986 of Western wilderness in general by two professors at Utah State, and they came to the conclusion that counties containing wilderness grew at a faster rate than those that didn't. How about tourism? Tourism is a big factor as far as the southern Utah town goes. It's not the answer, but what can be done so that these little small towns, what can be done in Escalante so that this place is more conducive to tourists? What will attract people to that area besides just the landscape? Shouldn't the state spend more of its economic development budget developing the talent that already exists in native Utahns instead of trying to lure these huge outside interests just because of promises of bigger dollars? Why can't funds be set aside to put together cottage industries just like in the past, only this time working with national companies who would contract with small Utah companies to make shoes, clothes, and other manufactured products? Why don't companies who make outdoor clothing and equipment set up shop in southern Utah where a lot of their equipment gets used every day by hundreds of people? Has anyone asked Nike to move the manufacturing of their hiking shoes to a place in southern Utah where a good percentage of them get used instead of Taiwan? Has anyone explained to them that there's a high probability that if there is one way to protect public lands in southern Utah, it's to raise the per capita income of the people who live there? Why aren't mountain bikes being made in Moab where so many of them get used? These are just a few questions I have, and I'm not sure if there's any real answers to them, but I think economics is the place where the two sides can come together and everybody can win if it's put together right. Thank you.
I'm almost embarrassed to come after Brett because I'm going to go into one of those fights where I think my side is right and the others think their side is right. Anyway, our story is the Provo, Utah story, and I'll just start out at the beginning. The good guys are Mormon, the bad guys are Mormon, and the people that don't care are Mormon. So this is the story about Mormons, okay? How I became a hysterical housewife. Several times driving up and down, my parents live in Salt Lake, I would drive past the source of the pollution, which I thought was the source. Last December, driving home and getting to the point of the mountain with my three-year-old, I dreaded the view I would see when I went around the mountain. Comparing valley to valley, mine looked worse, much worse, and I dreaded going down into that sea of rusty-colored smog. As I got down to the point where I turned left, instead, this time was different, I turned right into what is known as Geneva Steel. I asked one of the workers very politely, where is the president and where is his headquarters? And I was told. And I went over to the headquarters that are very large, not knowing what I would say, woke up my son, didn't dare leave him in the car, and went up there and said, where is your president, Joe Cannon? And they said, we're having our Christmas party. Now, I hadn't got enough muscles at that point to interrupt with a carol of my own choosing. So I took a piece of paper and proceeded to write him a note. And as I'm writing a note, asking him how so-called good people on high councils, bishops, etc., could pollute this valley and jeopardize the health of our children. As I'm writing this, the most beautiful Santa Claus comes in, and the most beautiful Santa Claus clothes, I hadn't seen this at the mall, came in and talked to my son, who had never seen at 2 years old, I'm sorry, he was two last year, never seen Santa in the flesh. I watched in delight as the Santa Claus was darling with him and gave him a candy cane, and I almost forgot why I was there, and if only that unsuspecting Geneva Santa knew what I was writing. I still gave the letter, and I left, and as I left, and we fought over the candy cane before or after dinner, I realized this sort of thing had been going on in my community, and I almost fell for it again. Obviously, this was an innocent public relation job. But this is the thing that had started getting me so angry, was the wonderful public relations this steel mill had done to this town. I did this another time, driving back up to Salt Lake City. This is my hysterical part. And I was driving up, and I couldn't see Timpanogos. Those of you who have been there, it's a rather large mountain close to the freeway. And I couldn't see it. And I said, now I know where he works. I went down again with my child, and I got the public relay. I didn't ask for Joe. I thought he might know me at this point because of other things. So I got the public relations man, and we went out, and we looked over to where Timpanogos should be. And I said, what is this air? And he said, what air? It's not that bad. And that's where we got. He said it wasn't bad, and I couldn't see Timpanogos. Okay, this hysterical housewife is from an article in On the Issues magazine. We're not the first. This is all about Love Canal that happened in 1974. I just want to read this, which is circulated between the hysterical housewives of the United States, to give us strength. Women committed to a cause, especially one being fought at the grassroots level, are often labored hysterical. Women activists are proud of the energy and emotions, which some people call hysteria. They know these emotions express their passion and strength and enable them to confront City Hall, Geneva, to stand up in a General Assembly meeting and fight for the right for clean air or for not having toxic waste in their case. The Clean Air Coalition was started 3 years ago before I knew about it. Another woman, Julie Mack, a housewife, saw this bad air in Utah County and wanted to do something about it. She couldn't find any kind of society or group to talk about the issues of our polluted air. So she put posters up in grocery stores, expecting, saying the night they were going to have a meeting. Now, Mormons in our town are very busy with all their church activities, and that takes up all their spare time besides their work, I guess. Anyway, she didn't expect too many people. 300 people came up to this meeting, and they were angry and were so thrilled to have some place where they could talk. She said, they were stuffing money in my pocket. Please do something about it. Linda Clark, who was president of the League of Women Voters, was one of these women. And she took that political little bit of clout she had and started working on it. Kimberly Clark, a woman whose child cannot go out of the house. Every time she goes out, she has a horrible asthma attack since she was 2 or 3 months. Her nostrils swell and she can't breathe since she was 1 or 2 years old and had to move to Sundance. She became a person that got our public officials involved. Mary Slover was without children. Most of these women with children, I myself, that's what got me going. But she didn't have children. She was just concerned for the community. And she was a wonderful fundraiser and got money for us so we could have lawyers for certain events, and I'll tell you later. Anyway, we sued the EPA, not the steel mill. Okay, let me read one thing starting with our problem. In the initial stage of discovering the problem, for example, most of these women have blind faith in the government. They are motivated by the suspicion or mistrust, but by the concerns for their health and the well-being of their children. And they believe that if they only tell the right person the right facts, the problem will be solved. In their search for the right person, they are frustrated at the lack of response from state and local officials. And as the search continues, they become outraged at the cover-ups and compromises. And there I did my search, and I started finding out the two mayors that won had their campaigns funded by Geneva. Geneva is the number one donator for political campaigns in the state. So, I mean, I don't know about you, but if someone gives me money, I have a hard time to, you know, I'm not there yet. So I kind of thought they weren't either, and we just didn't expect, and we had seen this with our public officials. They are sort of funded by Geneva to get where they are. Anyway, and as their search continues, outraged at the governments and cover-ups and compromises they find, they keep searching and educating themselves, and before long, they are more knowledgeable about the issues than the authorities are. Now, with this Clean Air Coalition, I found some things. How dirty is our air? Am I making this up knowing so many sick people? And that's what got me angry in the first place, were so many sick people. Well, if anyone read the Tribune a couple of days ago about the carbon monoxide level, anybody read it? We were number 10 in the nation. Now, we had 12 days out of compliance down in Provo, Orem last year with the carbon monoxide. I moved here from New York City. They had 17 days. Who's been to New York City? I think the car situation in New York City, Provo, is a little different. But that's really pathetic. But the sad thing is it's the particulate matters. PM10 is what our big problem is. See, the carbon monoxide isn't our big problem. We're number 2 in the nation in the most particulates in the air. And these are produced by the steel mill making steel and wood-burning stoves. In the metropolitan city, they took a small city count, and Linden was number 2, which is right by Geneva, number 2 in the United States. West Orem was number 3. When they did a whole metro analysis, Provo, Orem area was number 2 in the United States. Oregon is number 1, by the way, a little town that does nothing but wood-burning stoves, and they're working on that. Salt Lake City was 5, so Salt Lake City people, get ready, okay? All right, so now we have some research papers, and there's millions of them. I'm just going to say 2 today. Dr. Victor Archer, who does the study of disease at the University of Utah, he did a study on Utah County and Cache Valley. And what he found was that we had a much higher cancer rate, respiratory cancer, lung cancer, than Cache County. But we also have a lot more death rate, just to any kind of respiratory, like bronchitis or emphysema. We are higher in the non-cancer death rate in respiratory illnesses than Los Angeles. Now, these start getting someone pretty angry. Dr. Arden Pope, I'll just tell the others, many studies, but I'm just sharing two. Dr. Arden Pope did a test of the year Geneva before they closed. They closed 1 year, and then the year they were closed and the year they were opened again of children admitted to the hospital, because this pollution seems to affect children the most. So the year before they were closed, the admission of children. Now, by the way, people who have pneumonia and are not admitted to the hospital. It's not a great place to go if you have pneumonia. These are the sickest people. And these children, we had 155 in the hospitals the year before Geneva was closed. The year they were closed, 55. The year they were open, 158 again. So these sort of things make someone rather angry to get the facts. For my English paper, I've gone back to school. I did my own study on steel making and how to make clean steel, and I realized that a steel mill in Alabama took $750 million to clean up. It's not an easy thing, and I feel sorry for Geneva because it's hard. It's a 40-year-old, as we say, dinosaur steel mill, and it's very difficult to clean up, extremely expensive. And also it cuts jobs to have a cleaner steel mill because the process is made smaller. So, after finding all this out and only living in Provo for 3 years, I thought, why do these people sit back and take it? I couldn't understand. Well, the story on the Love Canal told me. There's two types of people this happens to, and this is talking about toxic waste, but it relates to us. Although toxic waste don't discriminate on the basis of race, religion, income, or education, people do. And because of this, the majority of people being dumped on are poor, uneducated minorities who are seen as weak and expendable. Or they are white, working-class communities where people have strong religious convictions about respecting authority. And that sort of hit home to us. So I realized things I could do. No, 30% of it is wood stoves, 30% are cars, 60%, something like that. Okay, I'm over 100, sorry. But it's around there. 60% is Geneva. So it's not all the steel mill that a lot of people depend on for their livelihood. So I said, forget it, no more fires. So that's my big contribution. Don't drive the car on inversion days, but I'm not needing the car so much. I'm a housewife. So, you know, I'm not making too many sacrifices myself. Cloth diapers has been the sacrifice. But I am trying to, I understand it's hard. Okay, so I want to clean up my community. The only way I could clean up that 60% and also working on the wood stoves, which is also getting a wood stove away from someone is like taking apple pie and their rifle away. It's a big deal. Now, I don't dare say these things in Provo, okay? And you probably are some from Provo. Don't report me. Okay, here we go. So we had our first protest. And ironically, it was the day that Geneva Steel decided to announce their cleanup plan, their $70 million cleanup plan, which was a start. But we knew Garn and Hatch, oh, by the way, who was very good friends with the president of the steel mill anyway, and has tried to bend backwards to help that steel mill go. Anyway, they all came down there. So I knew, coming from New York and doing some television things, the television will be there. So we went, and I was told there'd be a lot of people there. So I just asked five little squeaky clean Relief Society types in my ward that are friends, and we went down with our post. I, you know, living in New York 10 years, I have never done a protest. I wait till Provo to be in a protest. So we go down there with our little signs, and first we called the police. What are the rules to protest? We don't know. We've never had one in Provo. Now, Kristen has told me and others, there have been a few, so I don't want to say that. There have been a few. We didn't let the Aryan Nation in, so that was good. Okay, there's hope. So we did that. I met the Geneva Wives that day, and I was proud of him for standing up. At that point down there, you're just glad anyone comes out with a view. And these Geneva Wives, this first time I said my word, they need their jobs. We've got to clean it up. We've got to give them jobs, something. I was just so angry until I met those Geneva Wives, and I started having a heart. Well, during this time was last fall, and you know a lot of good things were happening in another communist country. I'm sorry, I had to say that. I was so inspired what happened in Berlin and Czechoslovakia, seeing those people show up, filling those squares, that I said, we have to have a march for clean air. And it was, you know, I told some people in the idea, and when I saw that only 10, 15 of us showed up at the other protest that I thought a lot would, I was a little bit nervous, but we went ahead with it. We decided to have it on Earth Day just because that was a good time. Well, did that open things up? Then I saw the real environmentalists. I'm the selfish one. When my habitat is threatened, I get mad. But these were real environmentalists, and we had a wonderful man named Dr. Sam Rushforth, who's been a professor of biology and environment, and he went around and gave these speeches, and he's in the coalition, and all of a sudden, I'd get these calls from people, and they'd all come to our committee meetings. And I said, Sam, what were you telling those people? He said, we all have responsibility to the earth. We all have unique skills, and you need to find where your skills can be used for this. And I had so many BYU students. I have to say, honestly, most of them were, the key ones that helped were from Maine, Oregon, Washington, these kind of states. They're a little bit ahead of us at these kind of things. And Orem High School was wonderful. They have a great plan. And Mountain View High School, which is right in the backyard of Geneva, and it takes a little more nerve to be that way, and they were wonderful. Lori Page, the one non-Mormon, was our recycle person, and she was also in charge of the Girl Scouts. She was just one in the Audubon Society. We were just so excited about her. Von Stokes with the Uinta National Forest came to our first meeting. He says, I have a vision. I want to plant trees. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could plant 100,000 trees? And that was a wonderful thing we could hook into that wasn't controversial. For us, it could clean the air. Obviously, we wanted it to blossom like a rose, unfortunately, Utah, the desert. But it was that we did it. And we donated money, and we also planted up to 100,000 trees and bushes. So that was something good. The march. I had to go down to the chief of police and tell them that I wanted a march. And they said, You can't have a march. I mean, you could do it on the sidewalk. I said, that's not the same. We only have the 4th of July march, the Christmas march, and the children's march, and that's it. And then when I was walking out from the captain of the police, he said, but thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. And for me, my stereotypes, because I'm not too bright, I was really afraid to go. I thought, the police aren't going to be for this. You know, I was putting them, anyway. And so then I kept having, so I said, I've got to go to the chief of police. I was getting stronger, and I went to the chief of police. And by then, a few things have come out about Earth Day, Kristen's article, and This People magazine, a few things I could show that we weren't just making it up, because they thought we were making up this day. And, they did. Hey, wait till you hear the end of this story, because it's great. Anyway, the police chief finally said, if you can get 500 people, and truthfully, I didn't think we could. If you can get, we'll close the street. And we went down 9th East by Carson's Market, big deal. Marched down there, and as I was leaving, the chief of police said to me, Sean, you know what has bothered me? All the eroding with the motorcycle vehicles and everything on the hillside below our mountain, and the way they're eroding that. He says, I've given tickets and tickets, and nothing worked. And what did work? Bishops together, I said, because it was high school kids, I said, tell your kids not to go motorcycling up here and eroding, and they don't do it anymore. So if we could just get it in the handbook. I mean, we laugh at this, but it's true. The bad thing is we've got to have it in the handbook. The good thing, once it's in the handbook, it usually takes off. It's just getting it there. Okay, the 500 did show up, and we marched down the street. It was wonderful. We had bagpipes. My five-generation Mormons were Scottish. We had Indians doing their dancing. And the Girl Scouts led, and some BYU students had a coffin. We were appropriate. We got down there. I wanted it to be a show that everyone would come to, so I had a parade, religion, and football. We had Brigham Young speak. That was James Arrington, and I had Ty Dempner, the quarterback. That was really hard to get, but he was wonderful. He wanted to. He's going into land management. Just trying to educate the public that this wasn't a bad thing to be involved with. So the parade went well. Now, I just want to say what's happened since, and I'm through. We have up to 2,000 members. 1,500 to 2,000 members are in the Clean Air Coalition. 8 months ago, the Utah Valley Medical Association joined. And so to have those doctors join was really wonderful. Now, guess what? The EPA is now watching our state. They have never seen such citizen involvement. What a change from what I have just read to you about sort of what we're supposed to be. Each state was supposed to have a cleanup plan by 1988, and the EPA was supposed to enforce that. Well, we didn't have it, so we used the money, and the EPA told us the only way to get something done is to sue us. So we earned money from a fundraiser, and we sued them, and they are making our state come into compliance. A lot of states haven't come into compliance, and now Utah Valley is going to be the first county to be changed with the state implementation plan, I never can say it right, to clean up our air. So that is something that's really exciting. So one person can make a difference. And I just want to close with this girl called me, who's the Earth Day person in North Carolina, and she just wanted to get to know me because I was part of Earth Day, and she says, oh, let me help you write your speech. And I said, what are you, a missionary? She says, yes, I'm an environmental missionary. She's an ex-Baptist, now Hindu, I don't know, but she thought we needed... She gave me scripture. She said, this is about Sodom and Gomorrah, Genesis 18. Individuals must take action to do the right thing. We can't throw up our hands. That the mess is too big to deal with. When Abraham asked, what if there were only 10 righteous in the city? God said he would not destroy it.
I'm not really prepared to tell you what the public policy of the Mormon Church is on the environment. And I doubt if anyone can answer that question today. But that's a beautiful subject to discuss at another time. What I'd like to do is try and take an example of how the Mormon Church responded to one of the most critical environmental issues the state of Utah has ever faced, and how it responded under great stress. In the context, incidentally, of the relationship between the Mormon Church on the one hand and a publicly elected official on the other. And that's an interesting situation because no matter what your religion is personally, once you become elected to public office, particularly as a chief executive, you inevitably, necessarily, and often deal with the Mormon Church. In the nature of how the state operates, the governor and the Mormon Church have to deal with one another. And that's an interesting relationship. All of us do it differently. And as you know, the Mormon Church does not get involved too often in the political process, but they do occasionally. When they decide that the issue has moral implications, they jump in. They don't particularly like gambling. They don't particularly like consumption of alcohol. They don't particularly, I found out much to my dismay, like the Equal Rights Amendment. And they take views on public issues on a case-by-case basis. So there is a formal relationship between the publicly elected official on the one hand and the church on the other. And that's a formal relationship in a sense. You simply have to deal with it. And I have had many experiences in that environment. And then there's another dimension which I'd like to just add to the equation before I talk about my example. And that is the informal relationship. You don't have to have it, but you need it. When you think about 70% or whatever that figure is of Utahns being Mormons, I guess 98% in rural Utah, I suspect, is still the case. Maybe a little less in Salt Lake County. That is a unique religious political situation. Something like Rhode Island with the Catholics in the state of Utah. And it doesn't make any difference who you are in the job. You have to live with the fact that the predominant faith has a very overwhelming impact on the political process. For example, even though 70% of the people in Utah are Mormons, what percentage would you think hold all the public offices that are Mormon? High 90s. How many mayors, city councilmen, legislators, every public office are Mormon? High into the 90s. How do they respond to their public responsibilities every day when they go to city council meeting or to whatever the public responsibility is? Do you think they leave their Mormon teachings at home somewhere, tucked in a bag? The state of Utah has massive influence on public policy and politics from the Mormon Church, and we might as well face up to it. The important thing is the Mormon Church doesn't tell them how to do it. They do not tell them how to do it except in the examples and exceptions that I have mentioned. There is one exception. We do have a bad habit of all of our legislators, whenever there's an issue that they're nervous about, they always run down to 47 East South Temple to find out how to vote. And the courage level of publicly elected officials in Utah is not as high, in my opinion, as it ought to be. Now, one of the interesting things the governor does, and the governor's wife, you are together with the leaders of the Mormon Church nearly every week. For some reason or other, you're on the same dais with Spencer Kimball nearly every week. And you form very close and important relationships. And in fact, Norm and I had developed a relationship with the Kimballs to the point that we were sitting on the dais at the Hotel Utah at, I think, the 85th birthday party of President Kimball, Norman Vincent Peale out to give the address. And Mrs. Kimball decides to tell Norma a story. She says, "Normie, you know, when I was a kid growing up down in Arizona and old Mexico, my father was very strict. And he never allowed me to dance with a young man putting his arm around my waist. You could touch the tips of the fingers, but that was it." And she was an Irish, by the way, that very brilliant family that we all know about. She was so smart, they decided they had to send her to BYU. And she got up there and she was invited to the first freshman mixer. It was a dance. And some handsome young guy from Mount Pleasant walked up and asked Sister Kimball to dance. She accepted. He put his arm around her waist. She said, "Norma, I thought I was pregnant." Lastly, about the informal relationship. What happens when a governor has a statute that says you got to appoint 5 solid, honest businessmen or women to a liquor commission? And nobody will take the job. What do you do about that? Well, what I did is I called Gordon Hinckley on the phone. I said, "President Hinckley, I got a little problem." And he said, "How can I be of help?" I told him, and he said, "Henry Richards will be there in the morning." Henry was the owner, as I'm sure you know, of Granite Furniture. And he is the one who made the famous statement at a liquor commission meeting, be sure and get in your 2-year supply. Well, I give you that background because I think it's important in terms of what I'm going to tell you about this very important environmental issue that I just want to use as an example of how the state responded on the one hand and how the Mormon Church responded on the other. The MX missile basing proposal of 1979. Do you remember when Jimmy Carter made the decision to deploy MX missiles? By the way, they weigh 190,000 pounds each. They are massive. And the theory was that we would take over the Great Basin. All of the deserts of the Great Basin of Nevada and Utah and put racetracks. And you would move the missile from one of 7 hideaways by rail on a horizontal basis so the Russians couldn't find it. And somebody said, how much space will it take? And I said, I don't know, maybe we better get a map. I got a map and I will tell you, I have never seen so many lines and little circles of 7 little places to put missiles in my life. There was a hearing down in Cedar City in 1979. Gunn McKay was in Congress, and I was to testify. And I had been sucked into the MX missile proposal a little, and then suddenly I decided we better do some homework. And we discovered that if the federal government were to come into the Great Basin and do this, it would literally suck up all of the resources, cement, steel, lumber, water, and all of the social needs, doctors, nurses, policemen. It would literally suck up and put in to the MX proposal all of the resources of the Great Basin. And there was literally a massive risk that we would not be able to build a bridge across the Jordan River. That really concerned me. And we got into a massive debate about that, and I am not going to touch on the military and the deterrent and the strategic triad and all of those issues, which are very fascinating. But the point is, the feature of this whole process that suddenly got my attention was the fact that if we were to do it, we would literally destroy the capability to sustain the environment of the Great Basin area of Utah, Nevada, and Colorado and other areas as we have done since 1847. And that was a big, big concern to me. One of the smart things we did, I employed a young man who said, you know what we ought to do? Let's go down and see the church. Let's go down and see President Hinckley about this and let him know what we're up to. Ken Olson and I would go down once a month or maybe every other month and brief the Public Affairs Committee of the Mormon Church on what we were about. Well, we went down and asked him if they wanted the briefings. And he said, sure we do. This is a very big issue. And we'd go down, present the stuff. Incidentally, we never asked, the church never said what they were going to do about it. We never ask them. Well, finally, in June of 1980, I came out against the MX missile basing in Utah, primarily for the environmental destruction. Well, that started a real debate. All of the Utah delegation was supporting the missile. Not happy with Matheson. Lots of debates, lots of controversy. Lots of news stuff. I ended up speaking at a graduation at Partoon, Utah, which none of you will know about. But it's out on the Nevada desert. It had two two graduates from high school, the valedictorian and the president. And I've got to tell this story on you, Bill, because it's one of the classic stories of journalism. Norm and I flew out in a helicopter, and I delivered a major address against the MX base in Utah. And the sight of one of those little, circular deals, right on the schoolhouse. So I ended up delivering a major speech. And the next morning, Norm and I left for Europe with Wendell Ashton, who was the publisher then, of the Deseret News. And we went into Holland, and you can imagine the interest, the missile interest in Europe vis-a-vis the MX missile in the United States. And we went to the consul's home that night after we'd flown over, and I had picked up a copy of the Deseret News, and on the back page of the B section was an article about my speech, 1 inch long. And I walked into the consul's house with Wendell as my guest. He said, "That was a fantastic speech you gave in Partoon, Utah. It has been published in full in the European Herald Tribune, and here's a copy." And he said, "How was it covered at home?" I said, "Ask Wendell." True story. Well, to pull us together, we came out against it. The public was more in favor of it than they were against it. Why is that? Utah is a very loyal populace. We support the national public policy for safety, for military defense. We are loyal, patriotic Americans. And that was basically the reason why a lot of people thought that I was being selfish, very much Utah-oriented, and not facing up to the national responsibility, although I proposed other solutions to the MX issue. Well, all of a sudden, the outcome of the whole matter is in doubt. And all of a sudden, I receive an interesting phone call from Neil Maxwell. He says, "I have something to tell you. The church will issue a public statement later on this morning opposing the basing of the MX missile in the Great Basin of the West." I said, "Please repeat that." It was the most incredible call I had ever seen. Up to date, we'd monitored, we'd briefed. I won't take a lot of time. I have just one little statement to make. It was on May 4th, 1981, and when the church came out, 1 week later, the polls had turned in 1 week from support of the MX basing to massive opposition to the MX basing. Now, does that tell you something about the clout of the church in the state of Utah? It's an incredible event. And I just wanted to read you one statement because it has something to do with what Kristen said earlier about Brigham Young, who, in my opinion, was a very thoughtful man about the land. He was a colonizer, a pathfinder. He understood what this was all about. And this is what the Mormon Church said on that day. "Our fathers came to this western area to establish a base from which to carry the gospel of peace to the peoples of the earth. It is ironic and a very denial of the essence of the gospel that in the same general area there should be constructed a mammoth weapons system potentially capable of destroying much of that civilization. With the most serious concern over the pressing moral question of possible nuclear conflict, we plead with our national leaders to marshal the genius of the nation to find viable alternatives which will secure an earlier date and with fewer hazards the protection from the enemy aggression, which is our general common concern." What they were really saying is, we came out here with a pretty good idea. We like that idea. We want to sustain it. We want to help solve problems. But when the chips were really down, Mormon Church stepped up to bat and very courageously, in my opinion, stepped forward on a major environmental issue. And no one appreciates how big that was. I spent 2 years of my life, almost daily, working on the MX missile issue before it was gone. So there is an interesting example about where the Mormon Church comes down on the environment. I close by repeating, I do not know what the policy of the Mormon Church is on the environment. I hope that that can be discussed a little later. But here's an interesting example in the public process where they had to stand up in public, had to take the flak and the responsibility, and ended up doing, in my opinion, exactly what was right. So that's my story. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panelists, and there is time for questions from the audience. Yes? I need to repeat the question for the benefit of the tapes, and if you'd like to come ask the question in the mic, that would be good, too. The questioner commented that the MX missile statement by the Mormon Church was not an environmental statement, but an issue of morality on the part of the church. And then further, the question is that he hears from many people that the millennium will come in 20 or 30 years, and therefore using the Earth's resources in any forever or until that time is justified and that everything will be solved. And the question is, do the panelists get this response from people they talk to, and what are they doing to educate people? Then again.
Well, what I was getting to in my introduction was that that's just one of the givens. I don't think anybody's going to get very far by telling those people that, no, you're wrong, the millennium is not going to come. It just doesn't work. And so that's what came through to me in the research that I did, is that there's got to be another. That's the higher plane I was talking about. We don't talk to each other on the high plane if we expect to get anything accomplished. I think we have to bring it down to a point where, okay, the millennium's going to come in 20 years, but let's deal with right now. Let's deal with what's going on right now. And as far as lumber is what you mentioned, and as far as CO2 development or whatever it might be, I think that they aren't so much interested in lumber and CO2, they're interested in an economy that will support their population. And I think if we can talk to them about what we can do to make their economy viable, I think those kind of things can dilute some of those natural resource problems.
The question is, are we comfortable with the church making pronouncements on environmental issues, knowing that they may go against or for whatever we as individual believe.
Very fine question, Mr. Redd. Let me comment a minute about the earlier point. I did not quote all of the statement of the church with respect to the social impacts and the environmental impacts in that statement as it impacted on that decision. But it is definitely, in my opinion, a part of that process. I do agree with you that the church does not willy-nilly come out on public issues that they don't put into a moral context. But in this case, that was their choice. They made that call, and I'm convinced that was a major step forward, something I haven't seen before, to be honest with you, in terms of an attitudinal approach to the future of the state of Utah. How do you figure where the Mormon Church is going to come out on public issues? I've been on both sides of decisions on that. I was out in front of the ERA a mile, and they came out against it, and somebody came up and said, how do you feel about it? He says, that's their call. I have my call. They just happened to come down on the MX on the same side. They could have come down on the other side. We'd probably have the MX here if that had happened. The interesting thing about it is I do not think we're in a position, Hardy, to decide how they will respond to public issues that have to be geared into the basis of some kind of a morality, and then they make a call. It's kind of like when the Supreme Court decide cases I've argued and I lose. You take the wins, you take the losses. Life is not made up of everything going your way. And you got to be mature enough, whether you're a Mormon or you're not a Mormon, to take responsibility for their choices and put up with them and debate them or disagree with them or do whatever you please. But I like the system. I'm not here to criticize the system. Lastly, I was thinking, now we talk about the church not stepping into this issue, not stepping into that issue. Rampton wanted to plant 1,000,000 trees. He says, we need 1,000,000 trees. And he was having a terrible time getting people to help him plant the trees. He calls up the Mormon church, says, will you help us get the trees planted? They planted 1,000,000 trees. It's amazing how many things happen that we don't really have full knowledge of. And in my view, the closer the relationship, like we tried to do in the MX, the better the chances are you're going to develop a positive and good result. And I'm content with that.
What we're doing, we found it's with the youth. We have to educate the youth. And we're doing programs in high schools. And that's where we're feeling they're most, and the college students were the most interested. And that's the way we're going. And at my feeling right now, I would be glad if they put anything, as I said, in the handbook. I just would. Anything. And I was honored in my Relief Society for Earth Day, and I fainted, and it was a wonderful feeling. That was the last place I thought this would, and everyone talked, I happened to be friends with the president, but still, they honored me, and they honored me in the newsletter, and I was really, that was wonderful. That was a step, that was something you'd talk about in church.
I think the governor's right that the church is going to make calls, and that sometimes we're going to be on one side and sometimes the other. I think there's a difference in a call like the MX that directly affects the state of Utah, which is, after all, the power base of the church and the home of people who are largely Mormons, and a national issue such as the Equal Rights Amendment, in which the church's lobbying activities throughout the nation defeated the amendment, not only for people in Utah, but for people throughout the country. Now, it's true that it affected MX for the country, too, but I think that there's a little difference. I also think that if you need a flood fought or trees planted, that the Mormon Church is terrific at doing those things. And, you know, it depends on how you're looking at it. I'm uncomfortable with it because of that mass support. You talk about the church taking flack, and it does, but when public opinion here can swing like that overnight, what flack are they really taking at home? You know, I mean, when they come out against the Equal Rights Amendment, everything reverses here. Or they come out against MX, everything reverses here. Yeah, those Gentiles and heathens and other places might give them some trouble, but they got a lot of support. In terms of the first question of where are we going and what about the millennium, I think we ought to remember that the first white people here also thought the millennium was coming, and they cut down the trees and pulled out the granite and diverted the water and used everything as they felt they ought to in order to subdue the land and make the desert blossom. They weren't thinking ahead to our day any more than most of us are thinking ahead 150 or 200 years. And I think that, again, let me just try this shift in perception where we're looking at means and end and process and product. We better not do these things because it will hurt us sometime, or it will hurt our children or our grandchildren sometime, if not now. What we're missing is that concept of living in harmony with life and with an earth that we say God has created, that God lives within with us. Just another example, I asked Clifford Duncan about this business of returning human remains to the tribes that are asking for them. And how does that come down in terms of respect? Are those remains being returned because of respect for the remains, because of respect for Native Americans, or what? And he said, well, I think that the white people are returning those because, first, they respect the law. Secondly, they respect Native Americans. And thirdly, they respect the bones. He said, now, from my point of view, I would respect the bone first. That belongs to someone. That spirit is still alive somewhere. Secondly, I would respect myself. And third, I would respect the law.
Our time is up, I'm afraid. I have to bring this to a close. And I'd like to thank the panelists for their thoughtful discussion of the issues. It's been a discussion of the sort that I think will help each of us here define and or maybe redefine our relationship to the land and to the Mormon philosophy also. And hopefully we can all find ways to prosper in the land and to let the land also prosper. Thank you.